Hi, I'm Michelle Fifa from Copra Fame and Shag Matthews Assistant, and you're listening to Shortbox Showcase.
Hi, I'm Em.
And I'm Alan, and I know that it's been a long time, but in fact, you are listening to Shortbox Showcase.
Episode 69, Updates, Feedback, and our dramatic return.
We do have feedback, but we do need to start with some updates. We have covered a lot of this over on our other project, Dorkness to Light, but let's give the abridged version, because for context, the last Shortbox Showcase episode was September 2020, otherwise known as 6 months of pandemic, and we're almost through, right?
Oh, I'm a level with you. That's a lot longer than I thought it had been.
Just a brief update. For me, the COVID era was a work-from-home situation, which was only a slight change from the mostly online teaching I'd been doing before. And as an introvert, you can identify with this, Em. It wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
For the first few weeks, or even the first few months. That summer, I wasn't so... And then... got a bit tougher month after month after month. And I'm glad that now things have, can we at least say leveled off? Normalized is not right.
No, but have reached a plateau of...
I mean, from a certain point of view,
we're
to some extent getting a few things back to normal.
Yeah. Here and there, we are actually doing some things
again.
We've
traveled. Restaurants are open. You and I have both finally released that 20 months of...
Oh, yeah, that was the big one. That was the big one. Getting to finally breathe to release all that tension.
And one of the things that made you tense... was that during COVID, because of COVID, your job at the university library was eliminated.
Yes.
And you spent a little bit of time without work.
Yes. I realized this, as you said, it was September, that the last update was, yeah, no job, but I'm going to try and figure out what we're doing going forward. So I now have a job again.
Yay!
It worked out that I was able to get unemployment basically as soon as the severance ran out. Right. I was able to get the job basically as unemployment ran out. Yeah. So that, I was very, very lucky in that case.
And you are still in the book biz.
I am still in the book biz and having a pretty great time, gonna be honest. New job is tough and long hours and physically demanding, but I really love it. And honestly, getting a job and getting back out and talking to people again was very, very healing, even though, you know, also then brought with it its own
stresses, sets of stresses
and difficulties and, you know, all that stuff, but definitely was a net good in the grand scheme of things. It worked out because it meant that my roommate had just quit her job, had then now left college. Will she go back? Maybe. Who knows? But as we released episode 68, I'd quite recently gone from a 2-income household to a 0-income household.
Now you're back to one.
We're now back to one, but that 16 months of no income kind of helped us to accommodate to that.
Right.
And to sort of work on sort of refiguring out like what things would look like going forward. And I'm quite happy. I'm quite happy with it on the grand scheme of things. It means I've finally started to release the death grip that Dragon Age has held on my brain. It's still there. It's still there. Don't worry. It is not going away, but.
Now, we will talk about your new job as we get through some of this feedback, because it relates. Also, by the way, happy 9th anniversary of Relatively Geeky. This will come out in mid-ish July, which is... Do you remember back when your dad was a young guy in his mid-40s? You were just out of college.
Oh, that's right. Fresh out of college.
You were just out of college and wide-eyed. And remember those days?
No.
See, for me,
I was lying awake last night thinking about that, doing the math of like, wait a minute, it's been almost a decade that we've been doing this show. Like, dang.
See, for me, if you think about, you know, podcasting as the hobby, you know, I've dedicated a chunk of my, you know, adult life to it. It's been most of yours.
Yeah. That was the thing. Doing the math of like, I've been doing this for 33% of my life.
Well, like I said, it's been a year and a half. So you know what?
We have
a little bit of feedback.
We have feedback.
Now, last short box in episode 68. A lot of people may remember this because we solved all of the comics industry's problems.
Right, yes.
And so there's not been any issues really in the industry since then because we solved them all.
Yeah, we fixed it.
Of course, there had been a bit of a delay before that episode as well, which was noted in some of the feedback. Sean Urbanski commented on you being back on the network. Must be the fall sweeps week for the podcast world.
Yup.
And this one, we're just trying to get this one in for the podcast awards.
Exactly.
This is going to be our submission for the 2022 awards shows. That's obviously why we're doing this.
For sure. Dr. Ange also commented about the ongoing topic of comics organization. I think the professor and I have talked enough that he knows that my system works. Within seconds, I can produce the issue that I want to show you. I would say it's probably 97% alphabetical, 3% logical when not alphabetical. And you've seen it in action.
This is one change that happened during COVID, is that we had some Zoom hangouts with buddies every now and then because we weren't meeting at conventions. So this was a way of getting together individually or in groups. And, you know, Ange was parts of some of those. And it was pretty amazing how someone would mention something about a comic book. Ange would disappear from the Zoom camera.
For about 35 seconds.
And then hold up that exact issue to the camera because he knew where everything was. It was impressive.
It's insane. It's genuinely, genuinely insane.
And from the Council of Geeks, who since they've sent this feedback, we've met.
Yes!
Thank you, Gallifrey One. Dearest Middletons, always wonderful to see a new episode go up, and I take no shame in eating up so much of your feedback space, they said while writing out a new piece of feedback that will undoubtedly take up a minimum of 10 minutes. Given my own extensive experience in corporate work environments, whenever a bigger company buys up a smaller one and goes, let's shake things up, I am filled with a deep sense of dread.
Yeah.
It really is that let's shake it up mentality, not just the buying up in and of itself. There's a difference between we like what you do, we're glad we've bought this asset, and the current state of DC might be the latter. Now, to be fair-ish, this isn't quite the same as Disney buying Marvel because Disney specifically wanted to acquire Marvel, whereas AT&T probably never cared about DC, and it just came with a Time Warner bundle that they really wanted. Now, the publishing arms of both companies could use a boost, kind of floundering when looked at in a vacuum, but last I checked, we don't live in a vacuum. Disney has taken a big-picture approach to the publishing arm and never really seems to have been bothered by the sales numbers because they don't view it as something that needs to be profitable in and of itself. It's a test kitchen. It's a place to try out characters and storylines in a smaller pond before bumping them up to the big leagues of movie or TV. Now, they don't say, aka Moon Knight and Ms. Marvel,
but
it's a place to let the writers and artists have their fun and see what comes out of it. If it was a standalone business, it would have to be profitable, but Disney appears willing to be the sugar daddy. The only real influence I've been able to detect is shifting some characters to be more in line with the films.
Yes, and that's definitely been a thing as far as the overarching, like, corporate involvement has been shifting character origins to either after or in some cases before the fact be more in line with properties and established concepts that they have from the MCU so that characters can make that transition from one into the other. I gotta say, not a huge fan of it. I mean, I've never been a huge fan of Marvel generally. Shifting Ms. Marvel away from Inhuman involvement because Inhumans flopped. That did hurt. That did make me sad. I've already been out of the MCU game for quite a while at this point. I didn't go see any movies at all during 2020, 21, most of 2022. But that was one that I did feel a little bit of regret about.
On the other hand, AT&T may well look at DC Publishing as a failing entity with little or no regard for its use at cultivating a core fan base or as a creative test kitchen. I do like this test kitchen concept.
Absolutely.
They want it to be profitable, which is what will ultimately harm it.
Yeah.
It's a passion industry. And as much as I didn't care for the direction DC had been going for a while, there was still clearly passion behind it. Yeah, say what you will about Geoff Johns or Dan DiDio or whoever. They loved comics, and they love these characters.
Yeah, absolutely.
We might not appreciate every bit of their stewardship. I think what is here in this feedback is correct about the passion for those characters and for comics. And this is how you stamp out passion, which kills what made the company special, which means that ultimately it will likely spiral until it's more or less killed off as an actual business and is just a trademark. You can look at video games and the pattern of monster company EA.
I have opinions. I have so many opinions on EA.
And their habit of buying small devs, mandating what they make, even if it's not what they specialized in before, driving out the passion, and then eventually closing the developer. Wow, okay, this turned into a bit more of a borderline rant, and also has been written with 50 minutes left to listen to in the podcast. Why do you do this to us? So maybe I should slow my roll. Let me put it this way. I don't remember the last time I was as happy as I am now, after being laid off from my corporate hellhole of a job and being able to cover my bills with my creative works. Well, just barely cover my bills. Check out Council of Geeks on Patreon to help me out, or just on YouTube because the views help too.
Boom!
Plug.
Self-promotion.
And I dread to even imagine what it would feel like to have this thing that I love under the heel of a corporate boss again. I think M made excellent points about DC having trouble evolving because of the ties to the old ways of doing things. And a restructuring has probably been overdue for some time. It just worries me that changes appear to be happening in every corner of the business, from executive to creative, which makes it appear that alterations are being performed with a broadsword instead of a scalpel. Marvel will eventually have to evolve to how customers wish to consume as well, but with Disney not treating it as an asset only, it feels like a far less pressing issue for them. So the idea of vending machines, I can't see it, but then again, I still don't get the appeal of Redbox, so I may just have a huge blind spot for this business model. Fantastic conversation, as always. Can't wait for the next one, whenever that may be, even if it's a year and a half.
Okay,
that part was
okay, you know what?
Geekily yours, Council of Geeks, she, they.
And then, with a P.S., because of course there is. Can I throw a really radical suggestion for saving comic books and or these characters we love so much? Now, before I say this, understand that this would absolutely not be in the interest of the industry, but in the interest of the art form. Okay. Are you sitting down? Here we go. Let them go public domain. For decades, companies, primarily Disney, have successfully lobbied to keep changing the rules for public domain so that their old IP doesn't slip out of their hands. Don't let them keep doing it. Let these characters become ours. Not all of them, obviously. Many aren't nearly old enough. But Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Mickey Mouse, let them pass into the public domain. And yes, I can hear the professor holding back a heart attack.
Where are my pills? Where are my pills?
And I can hear others yell, the market will be flooded. But first, remember that it would really only be the name and core concepts that would go into public domain first.
This is true.
Anything done later has its own separate clock, different from the core character. This is why Frank L. Baum's Wizard of Oz is in the public domain, but the things unique to the film adaptations are not, and that interpretation has its own copyright protection separate from the novels.
That's why, and this might be under English law, which is going to be somewhat different, but the original drawings in the original Winnie the Pooh books, what is known as Classic Pooh, that design element is in the public domain, but
the red shirt,
the cartoons and the red shirt and those elements that are more modern, those items are still protected. Just as another example, the book Frankenstein has been in the public domain for decades, perhaps a century now, but certain design elements associated with the Universal pictures, including things like bolts in the neck, very specific items of the design and the makeup are still trademarked. So they point out here a very nuanced difference between the character itself falling into public domain, which does not mean every story, every design element, all of those other things still have, as we said here, their own clock. And I think that's part of the discussion that is often left out of this discussion.
And as they continue, what this allows is anyone with an idea to take a crack at the characters while being legitimate as any other. Sherlock Holmes, Robin Hood, or heck, anything from H.P. Lovecraft would all fall into this same sort of concept. Just because anyone can use the idea doesn't mean the cream doesn't still float to the top. New ideas, insane ideas, ideas unhampered by continuity or editorial mandate. Ideas that aren't allowed to come up within 1,000 yards of these characters at this time. And beyond potentially revitalizing these characters, it will limit the ability of IP holders to just keep recycling the damn thing every single year. Because eventually, it does get handed over to the rest of us, and they need to introduce new stuff. This was where I went from, that's a good idea, to, oh, this is genius. This would create incentive to bring back the creativity the big two have been lacking for quite some time, assuming the purse string holders would allow such long-term planning as opposed to hitting quarterly targets. There you go. Too radical an idea to be allowed, but I stand by it. You are absolutely correct. This is genius. I have actually said this before, that my favorite interpretation of the DC universe is written by a 34-year-old woman on the internet named Kitty Unpretty. Her interpretation of the DC universe is absolutely phenomenal. And one of the reasons is it does exactly what they're talking about here. Takes the core concepts and ideas of characters as created in the 40s and 50s and 60s, and then applies them to modern situations with modern concepts, but almost entirely ignores the continuity that went between point A and B. It takes the characters and transplants them into the modern era without having to deal with any of the long, extended periods of time that were kind of like, you know, a hamster on a wheel, recycling certain elements, sometimes reinterpreting or recreating them, but still creating that history, that long span of time. I'm just going to throw this out here and just say, you should at any point Google Kitty Unpretty Sorrowverse. It is her interpretation of the DC universe, and it is fantastic if anyone is interested in some really, really well-written character-based fan fiction. And the fact that she cannot have a novel deal out of it legitimately has bothered me for years. I would 100% buy it. It is very in keeping with the Lois Lane reinterpretation novels, things like that. And I cannot describe how much I wish that I could give money to her creative interpretations of these characters. And if the IP was public domain, she would absolutely be able to do that. I would do that in a heartbeat. I would do that absolutely in a heartbeat.
Let me ask you this, in the spirit of unintended consequences, if people could legitimately make money off of these classic characters, what would that do to the fanfic world? And if it hurt it, would it be worth it?
Man.
Because to me, my sense is that part of it is this can only be for fun. This can only be between us. Let's all go crazy together on this.
Which is definitely how fan writing communities, right, in my opinion, should be. You have actually opened a can of worms.
But if there was a chance that one of us could break out and create a bestseller, we might not be as friendly in our sharing and our community.
Here's the thing. It's already happened. And this was not going to be a thing that came up for me working at a bookstore now. But in the romance world specifically, there has been a large boom in independent writer, new writer, IP collection. And a vast majority of those properties that have been published through traditional publishing houses and sold in brick and mortar stores have not only started as fan fiction, but actively do not hide the fact. It was a thing when Twilight and then following that 50 Shades of Grey came out.
Right.
There was always an air of obfuscation.
Right.
Where it's, we all knew, but you couldn't say, mostly because Anne Rice was still alive at the time. And Anne Rice's litigation team is notorious.
Mm.
And honestly, even after her passing, remained something of a vampiric specter in the fan works world. Now that we've gotten farther away from that, people are less concerned about things like litigation. And although it still lives in very much a gray area at the time, these things have in fact happened. It's one of the romance novels, I believe by a woman named Tessa Dare, that is very specifically Schitt's Creek fan fiction and says so in the dedication, says this novel was written with passion for the characters created by and performed by, and lists the entire writing staff and cast as acknowledgments and says, thank you for inspiring this piece of fan fiction.
Wow.
And it is, in fact, a novel that I have not read, but my coworker who does most of the romance purchasing has. It very specifically, as a piece of fan fiction, exists on pre-established things. It cannot really be read on its own. It is a supplemental material.
Wow.
But it has still been legitimately published. And that is wild to me. That has already sort of started. And some of that competition then about, that was my idea. Well, it wasn't your idea. It was a trope. It's a pre-existing trend. What can and can't now be copyrighted as part of your individual work built on a community of fan works that up until now has gone very specifically unnoticed. At what point can you claim originality for an idea that came up through that sort of community writing? It's already happening. And honestly, I think that this idea from the council would be a really good kind of break on that to say, actually, everything is legitimately equally valid. And if you don't like it, that's fine. But then sort of breaking that into what is then public domain and publishable versus permitted, but still not legal, I think would actually help clear up a lot of that.
One of the things that you said there got me thinking, and I don't think I'm going to be breaking any news here, but I am not thoroughly familiar with all the details of Romance Writers of America. But my impression is that in that genre, the authors actually are friendly and encouraging of each other, partly because the readers in that genre are voracious.
Yes.
And if I have a romance book published that's really good, it doesn't mean they're not going to read yours. They're going to buy and read them both.
Correct.
That may be less true in other genres.
Very much so. And the RWA is also just an extremely interesting entity that I am not going to open a can of worms on at this point in our comic book podcast. But The RWA is a really interesting example for that reason, because there is that push for more community collaboration. Mm-hmm. Because, quite frankly, a lot of those people did get their start in fan fiction.
Right.
What is odd now is people getting their start in fan fiction, but then not moving into the RWA because right. they're being directly approached by publishers. And that's something I'm not a huge fan of.
Right.
I do, not to be all like gatekeep about the whatever, but the RWA does a really good job of sort of bridging that gap
right.
from fan work to traditional publication by giving you a community. And that is honestly my biggest concern with things like Wattpad publishing, which kind of cuts the RWA out of this. Ooh. Not that Wattpad does specifically right. romance, but it does a lot of romance and also young adult. And it's kind of cutting out these community mm-hmm. groups, mm-hmm. which, yes, gatekeeping, but right. also regulation and also community
right.
that is sort of starting to be lost in certain elements of traditional publishing.
Interesting.
So... as always, thanks for the Council of Geeks
for that thought-provoking and discussion-provoking bit of feedback. After that last episode was released, Sir Manuel Carmona said, if you're going to listen to one podcast this week, you need to check out the latest installment from Relatively Geeky. If you love comics, are a comics retailer, or comics creator, this is an episode you need to listen to ASAP. Or in the next 18 months.
You know,
I think that was
whatever.
Odd.
I think that we were all living in COVID time, i.e. time was meaningless. And we also received another long and thoughtful piece of feedback from Clinton Robison of Coffee and Comics. Alan and M, another fine and wonderful episode. These do not come out nearly often enough, but when they do... they are more than full of the content my brain craves. A few thoughts on the episode as I am listening. M's summarization of Supernatural and how the staff reacted to the online fanon. Oh ye gods, yes. So much this. I had to back up the podcast and listen again because I was fist pumping in agreement so hard I thought I might have missed something. The creators of the show had originally set out to tell a 5-season story with a definitive ending. Period. Fade to black. Strike the set. Goodbye. Instead, CW continued to milk an additional 10 stinking seasons out of that show with dubious levels of quality, and it never seemed to fail that there would be popular fan theories for where the show was going, and lo and behold, like the word of Chuck, Supernatural fans will get the reference, it would appear within the show, or go the complete 180, just as M put it, to spite the fans. Either way, this is a perfect example of why the creator should never start reading the fan works. If you're out of ideas, just say so and cancel the show.
I have one brief comment on that, and that is I go back to J. Michael Straczynski after the 5th season of Babylon 5, which there's strangeness between how that 5th season came to be, but TNT picked it up and let him finish off his show. And then they approached him with the idea of doing sequels or spinoff shows, which were not part of his original creative vision at all. But as that last season was winding down, he looks out at the crew. Not so much the cast, they'll move on, but the electricians and the gaffers and the craft services, and realizes that if I make another show, I can keep hiring these amazing people. And I think that is a wonderful impulse that sometimes does not serve creativity the best. You know, canceling a show puts a lot of people out of work. There will be another show to replace it in the network schedule, but it's not going to be the same people that you knew, the same people you've worked with for 5 or 8 or 10 years. So I think that makes that decision as it hits your desk as the creator, as the executive producer, as the showrunner, to turn down the offer to keep going. It makes it a little more difficult.
I love that insight. Clinton said on my take about Azula, exactly. Thank you. Not every character in every show is redeemable, nor are they meant to be sympathetic for having a tragic backstory. Sometimes characters are purely evil, and their oh-so-tragic backstory proves that instead of rising above their situations to become better people, they sunk to the depths and became deplorable. I've got to say, I completely forgot bringing up Azula at all on that episode, but I'm glad. I have a lot of thoughts on redemption, and spoiler alert.
We may talk about those one day on Darkness to Light.
It's going to be upcoming, and there is going to be a lot of thoughts that I have on that. Clinton points out that there was a similar situation a few years ago with the Voltron revival. An excellent series, by the way. I highly suggest everyone check it out. I will put in my two cents to say everyone should check out the first three seasons.
Oh, snap.
Not a huge fan of the later ones. With spoilers ahead, there was a hashtag justice for Lotor circling around when the writers didn't cave to Fanon about Lotor and Allura becoming a couple, him being a misunderstood villain who needed to be heard, who can be redeemed through the power of love. Nope. Lotor was written to be a cunning villain who only cared for himself, and it worked perfectly. No need for redemption here. The story was not about Lotor turning out to be a good or misunderstood guy. The show isn't called Voltron starring Lotor, after all. Inserting a random Constantine mention here because M says they are, quote, best part of the emails. And since this has been M-focused thus far, for Professor Allen, here is a Hail Doom.
Ah, thank you, Clinton. I feel like Steve Rogers. I get that reference.
A 2020 version of Jeanette Kahn, eh? Now, I could get behind this idea. Unfortunately, they'd probably bring in somebody from the movie and TV divisions to make the comics more in line with that side of the franchise. Knowing the bigger companies. But what do I know about anything? I could just be the biggest negative Nancy about the whole thing. Well, that doesn't mean you're wrong, though.
One problem with the comics and the TV and movies being so inextricably linked is that there is a temptation to maybe populate the show with, I don't know, characters you've created. Or characters your buddies have created.
Mm-hmm.
Or characters that your buddies who are executive producers of other shows have created. As opposed to figuring out who the best character would be for this particular piece.
Considering that whoever is in the movie or the TV is going to get an action figure, which is going to have residuals. Again, it all comes back to the money.
The answer to all of your questions is money.
Regarding the DC app, Clinton says, I'm perfectly satisfied with shifting all video content to HBO Max and expanding their comics content to essentially become DC's answer to Marvel Unlimited. Stop floppy publishing? I shudder to think that this would happen, but M's probably right. I mean, if everything is written for the trade anyway, just do the online singles and release physical graphic novels, trade paperbacks for the storyline, right?
Possible.
Okay, so when Alan and M started talking about licensing characters and webcomics getting collected, they both pretty much made my point for me. You can probably ignore the above. We won't, but thank you for the permission. Randomly curious if John Constantine would get along with Dr. Doom now.
Oh, I'm finally paying attention again to what Clinton is saying. Huh?
I mean, they could both talk about dark mystic arts, people they know trapped in hell, etc., etc. Oh, sorry, not necessarily relevant. But you know what?
I found it relevant.
I would be interested in your fanfiction, Clinton.
Hello!
Professor Allen talking about how the Doctor Who trades worked as an example of that restructured DC is pure bliss. Somebody get this man into publishing. Wait, would that make Professor Allen the 2020 Jeanette Kahn? You know, if it works, I'll take it.
I am almost sure that the publishing industry does not award tenure. So, I think I'm going to pass. Thanks, buddy.
I'm with them. Writing for the trade is not good. Bring back done in one and short two-part stories. Many creative writing classes will tell students it is always easier to write a novel than a short story, because with unlimited pages, you can make your story as long or short as needed. Short stories force the author to tell a coherent story in a condensed format. Similarly, single-issue stories or two-parters help comic writers focus and refine their stories, at least in theory. Besides, like you said, we don't always need cliffhangers and dangling third acts. Anyway, I'm sure I have taken up way too much space in the podcast section, and as I hardly produce the quality commentary that... Now hang on a second. We love both you and the council, and we adore having you literally dominate our feedback sections. I shall simply say thank you once again for the wonderful episode, and I look forward to hearing more, and hopefully more often. Clinton Robison. P.S. Now I have to wonder how Constantine and Doom would organize their comic collections. Of course they have them. Why wouldn't they? No, you shut up! Of course the people need to know.
Let me reveal a ongoing messaging thread I've had with Clinton during the year of 2022. So at one point a few months ago, I noticed that on the podcasting app, when shows get inactive for 60 days, 90 days, they fall into a separate menu. And I was scrolling through that one day, and I noticed that his Days of High Adventure and Darkness to Light were right there together, both in the inactive stage. Messaged him about that and, you know, sort of challenged who's going to win this fight. And of course, that happened to be right before our last Darkness came out. He replied a week or two later with a Days of High Adventure podcast and then said, "So, Short Box Showcase." He thought he had the mic drop. Hello, Clinton, buddy. Here we are.
Now what?
And from Sir Martin of Grey. Thanks for another fun and stimulating show. I'm very much behind Professor Allen's idea of a line of anthologies. The received wisdom is that they don't sell, but the massive price point has a lot to do with that. Reduce the production values given we're not after the collector's market, bring on the economies of scale allowed by widespread distribution, and away we go. I'm less down with M's idea of a webcomics model. Let's just stop here and revel in the fact that I actually won one feedbacker, okay?
And it's Sir Martin!
To me, that counts as two. That counts as two. I like the idea of, say, annual big stories, but publishing them in dribs and drabs a couple of pages a week, that would drive me mad. I'd have to look at them, and it would be really dissatisfying. I don't follow comics because I love the form per se. It's that this is the form in which I found worlds I want to follow. And if I can't get a whole story, I need nice chunks. But we're going to publish them in trades.
Which is then still a pretty long wait. It's definitely a change in consumption, very much similar to the concept of the Netflix for the binge.
Right.
But almost in reverse now, that as TV has been sort of moving more towards large chunk done-in-one stories, comics might move towards smaller sections released more frequently, which is an odd shift.
Right.
I definitely get that, and would have some pretty big implications on, like, the storytelling for both types of media.
Mart continues, "I don't doubt that First Second, who don't have any presence in the UK market that I know of, are big and excellent, but it sounds as if they're in a very different market spot to DC and Marvel. And I want my soapy power fantasies."
Absolutely.
Nothing wrong with superheroes. "And I definitely want new stories. Even characters like James Bond and Sherlock Holmes, whose original authors died decades ago, get new adventures. I want tales that build on the heroes and universes I love. As for DC co-publisher possibly not being a full-time job, because one half of the equation finds time to script the occasional miniseries while the other does some covers, well, that's what weekends are for. Come back soon, Mart." You know, it just depends on your definition of soon, okay?
And literally just a few days after that episode, Karen from Between the Pages sent us an article about Archie Comics announcing a plan to team up with Webtoon for new scrolling comics. Archie has taken M's advice. Okay, I'm going to put another pin in this one. Because
okay, so I've got Martin on my side, but you have Archie Comics on your side. I call that a draw.
I would agree. Because Martin mentioned First Second beforehand, First Second being sort of like the primary independent publisher of graphic novels specifically, because we've gone on this discussion before about the difference between a graphic novel and a collected trade of comics. They are fundamentally different things. First Second has recently been to some degree teaming up with and working with Webtoons, because Webtoon has become kind of the big go-to thing, with webcomics to traditional publishing being the new pipeline, because that's where the Netflix money is. That's your Heartstopper. That's your Lore Olympus. Those are like the biggest big sellers. Not so much ongoing, but as far as sheer volume of physical trades that we have sold at our physical brick and mortar bookstore, those are the big money.
Because that's what I wanted to ask you, because you're in an interesting place now, because you are working in a traditional bookstore. Part of what you sell is graphic novels. You're in the comic book business, but not a comic book store.
Exactly.
So in that context, big picture, what are the things that y'all sell in terms of DC and Marvel trades versus, is it Lumberjanes and Goldie Vance, the boombox, the younger stuff? Do you have sort of big picture thoughts besides what you just shared on sort of what y'all sell in the comics world in a non-comics retail setting?
Biggest things are honestly anything that could be considered literary. And this might just be our own, like,
right,
you know,
your own niche
market share and like customer base, but the big name literary stuff is the stuff that goes all the time. Of course, anytime there is a banned book, there is always a rush on banned books. So Mouse has been the big, big seller for the last 6 months or so. And then anytime that there is a Netflix show, like it has actually, Heartstopper was such an out of left field thing because it is free to read on Webtoon. You can get the whole thing online for free, but people want to own it.
I can't wrap up the Webtoons website for my buddy, for to give it as a present. So that aspect also, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Of having a hard copy.
It's not surprising, but it is interesting. As far as Marvel, the big thing that really sells is actually the shorter style, almost mass market type of graphic novels, which are collected for various different characters and intended for the younger readers.
Interesting.
That is the big thing, is that for the most part, the people that I see buying and reading ongoing Marvel is back to the 10 to 16 range. Whereas the DC stuff that sells is usually to older fans, and they are the large collected coffee table editions, things like that.
Are there evergreens? Is Watchmen always on your shelves, or Dark Knight Returns always on your shelves? Those sorts of things, do they move, or do you have any sense of, that's just a curiosity question.
I will say not really, because those are things that I feel like people tend to have their preferred editions.
True, true. And they would come and go maybe when the Watchmen TV show.
Exactly.
Of a few years ago, you may have sold some then.
It mostly does tend to be dictated by whatever the ancillary media is. That whatever ancillary media is currently big will usually sell some associated collected trades. But especially with the Marvel, the thing we mentioned earlier is what people want is they want the things that are like the TV show.
Right.
So they're not going for the older collections of X-Men. They're not going for the older collections of even Deadpool from like early 2000. They want the modern and current.
And if they're looking for Moon Knight, it's not the 1980s version.
Exactly.
It's whatever Jeff Lemire or whatever other version most closely resembles what they're getting on the TV.
Mm-hmm. And I have seen this recently, is there was a, because of Penguin Publishing their connection with / acquisition of some other publishing companies, Penguin Classics now has comic book collections. And we recently received, for Marvel specifically, there are now Penguin Classic editions of Captain America, of Iron Man, and of Spider-Man, I think, are the three that we have. They are essentially the Tales of, or the
Greatest Stories Ever Told sort of collections.
Essentially the Greatest Stories Ever Told. But what they do is, what we were talking about here, they're lower quality paper because right. they're Penguin Classics. They're literally pulpier paper. Mm-hmm. They're not quite as expensive, but they're very, very big, kind of cheaply produced.
Right.
And all of the stories are all from the before the 70s. Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting thing. I haven't seen a ton of them moving yet, except for Spider-Man. People always want Spider-Man, right. yep. and they always want classic Spider-Man.
Interesting.
Spider-Man, I think, is probably the one that people want the most of. People tend to want whatever the newest Miss Marvel, the newest right. Captain Marvel, the newest Captain America,
but Spidey, they want the classic.
Spidey, they want the classic.
Interesting. One more question for you, then we'll get back to feedback.
This is sort of an
intermission. I know from Free Comic Book Day that DC has pushed for years original graphic novels aimed normally to a teen set. Raven, young Bruce Wayne, Robin. Any sense on any of that? Have you seen any of those or any sense if they sell through your store?
Everybody loves Raven loves Beast Boy. I will say that one specifically.
There's a Raven yes. one and a Beast Boy solo too. So yes. I imagine all three of those.
All three of those
that
sell.
That was my question.
All three of those sell and they sell well.
Well, thank you. Back to the feedback. And we got this from Bon. Jack Bon. Dear Showcasers. Have we ever called ourselves Showcasers? Because if not, it's 68 episodes.
Too late.
Too late to start that, but...
But dang.
Dear Showcasers, your episode on the future of the comics industry came up on my playlist as I was taking a surprise opportunity to drive to a nearby city which supports several comic shops. The first such trip since probably last fall.
Which at this point would have been fall 2019.
Exactly. I didn't have the prep time to plan out a circuit or even glance at a physical map to refamiliarize myself with the street names and... It being on a weekday afternoon, I didn't know how much of a circuit I could complete anyway. So I plugged one of the shop names into the GPS. When I pulled into the L-shaped strip mall, the comic shop was gone. The whole mall was abandoned. The signs above the shops gone or painted over. Painted names on the doors scraped off, the windows empty. That shop had never struck me as the most businesslike of businesses. Its ambiance was more of a fan's overstuffed attic. Still, it probably would have been my first choice if I could only go to one comic shop. And I could never be sure I'd seen everything that was for sale there. Maybe it reminds me of home, but you didn't hear me say that. I plugged in another destination, and while driving, I noticed that I'd actually been several streets over from where I should have been. There was the L-shaped mall, the comic shop, the restaurant bar next to it, which also seemed as busy as any other time. A feeling of relief, but also an unfocused feeling of sympathy for that other place and those other businesses no longer doing whatever it is they were doing that wasn't selling comics. So we got deep into Jack's head on this one.
Yeah.
Even a 21st century Luddite like me saying, this far and no further, has to agree that digital is the way to go. And is ready whenever DC decides how they want to make money off it. It's the idea of getting comic books back in general distribution that's a hard sell. I've been told general stores don't like cheap comic books. They bring in less money.
Yeah.
That's why the 100-page giants have to bulk up to a higher value. So I'm listening, and I'm wondering, what does a professor of finance know that I don't? Oh, we're not aiming for the price of other magazines. But the price of movie rentals from a pop-up wherever there's a crowd box. This gives additional benefits to the DC IP that's beyond the Trinity. The general public who don't download a special app or go to the collector's aisle of Walmart will be regularly exposed to the names and distinctive likenesses of Zatanna or the New Gods or Detective Chimp. Oh, that would be the day. That would be the day.
I gotta say, I did feel a spark of joy the other day when I heard a small child, maybe four, maybe, walking through the store going, I got Gorilla Grodd. Gorilla Grodd is the best. And I was like, the kids are all right.
As we say, it's not really a DC comic until a super smart talking monkey shows up. Jack continues, there might eventually be a cover that inspires a sale, but even if not, there's awareness that these exist for future movies or TV. And really wish DC would give it a try, which is why I'm guessing they won't. Back to stores. With us all on the app, comic shops merely the shop local alternative for ordering hardcover collections of worthy story and art?
I mean, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they still have statues, figures, and toys for the next decade until home 3D printers can handle plushies.
Oh, God.
And they have long boxes full of what exactly? Are comic shops suited more for being antiquarian bookstores to the Barnes & Noble than trying to be the Barnes & Noble of their small pond?
Ooh.
As you and I have discussed, you work at a new bookstore. You regularly recommend people look for their out-of-print books at half-price books.
Yep.
They're not a direct competitor. They are in a different niche of the book-selling market.
Yep.
There is a difference between new comic sales and old comic sales.
It's true.
Interesting.
I was actually thinking, because there are two major comic shops in our city. I would say major. Mm-hmm. One of them is RLCS, so right. I consider it major. And then there is another major comic book. But that major comic book store is much more of a Barnes & Noble. That it is sleek and clean and focused. And it's got big displays and, you know, well-crafted end caps to promote the most recent things.
It's clean and well-lit.
And I don't shop there.
Yeah.
For the exact reason that I would rather go to our LCS and sit on some industrial carpeting and go through a long box. And I think that's very insightful, mm-hmm. considering them more as antiquarian stores and mm-hmm. specialty stores who have access to distributors that other places don't have.
Right.
That's also the thing that I always tell people. It's like, we do our best to have a decent collection of graphic novels available, but it's all going to be limited by our store's right. distribution.
Right.
If you go to a actual comic store, which then would be more in the antiquarian market, they have a completely different skill set.
Right.
They have tools that we don't have. They're going to be the ones who can hook you up with the very specific edition that you want. Somebody wanted Death in the Family, alternate ending where Jason
right.
Todd lived. And I was like, though I wish that that was a publicly available book that we could keep in our store all the time. It is not, and we cannot. And you should go to World's Greatest Comics.
The owner of which has shopped at your store before, so it's all good.
It's all a
good.
Circle.
But obviously, as a bookstore, you do not have a Diamond account. However, you have an ongoing relationship with Penguin Random House.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's always who you know.
Exactly.
Jack says that since this is his first feedback in the short box, a comment on the perennial topics. I've only read Watchmen once, borrowing a friend's trade around 1989, but it does stick in the memory, with many quotes, most of them from Rorschach. I wonder if Moore would be comforted by the thought that we enjoy dressing up as Rorschach by quoting him, but don't really believe he has a worked-out philosophy of life, like how we didn't really believe tying a cape around our necks would allow us to fly. I finally opened up the Motion Comic DVD, to look at it before writing you. Wow. From your analysis of the formalism of the comics pages, I can only guess this would quickly cause jaw fatigue from the gritting and grinding of teeth.
Yeah.
And before your discussion, I'd only thought of the Black Freighter as a clever way to run a backup strip in the book when the main story was a few pages short.
Which, to be fair, it probably also was.
Also a secondary feature. I should talk about sorting comic books, but as the seed of my collection is guest appearances by the Squadron Supreme and Squadron Sinister by their chronological order.
Jack?
I don't have much to say.
Jack?
I generally find what I'm looking for before I forget what it is that I'm looking for. Now we have Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us. I think we may have a candidate for the, other side of the spectrum.
And from our original feedback from way back when, Sir Luke Giaconetti.
Please, our original OG feedbacker.
Professor and M. Just finished listening to discussion of the DC comics and the whole dad blam DC comics industry and wanted to share some thoughts. First off, regarding fan ownership, fan and word of God, etc., I fall on the side of the creators. No matter how much fan work you do, no matter how many podcasts or YouTube videos or fanfics or Tumblr pages you produce to celebrate and promote that book, comic, game series, band, whatever, you are not the creator, and you do not have any actual stake in the product. You are the consumer in this relationship, not the producer.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing to me that some fans who scream about creators' rights in certain avenues also scream that without the fans, the creator would be a failure. Not sure how one does the mental gymnastics required for that one.
Fair.
Agreed.
Fair.
As far as the future of DC Comics and Marvel, for that matter, there are two terms and two terms only which readily spring to my mind. IP farming and trademark protection.
Here we go for our legal spin-off show.
Exactly. The purpose of the publishing houses now is to provide a central location for IP, which can be groomed and spruced up for movies and TV shows, while the individual periodicals allow trademark to be continually refreshed. Even smaller publishers fall into this. Valiant was purchased by a venture capitalist group specifically to farm their IP for media. As an aside, Valiant has been doing story arcs under 6 issues pretty much since the current version of the company launched. Most stories at Valiant are either 3 or 4 issues in length, with one-shots and one-and-dones mixed in as well.
Nice. And of course, there was a Bloodshot movie. I mean, there was a Valiant comic book hero on the big screen, for better or worse.
Marvel has taken the approach of rearranging the deck chairs for their characters.
True.
Reshuffling and jiggering around different combinations of existing characters so they have new ideas to market. Jane Foster as Thor is a great example. Good, bad, or otherwise, it takes 2 existing characters and mashes them up to be marketed to a new audience. I will say as a quick aside, the most recent bad example of this was Miles Morales as Thor. Yikes. Yeah.
Okay.
Is bad. Is bad, dude. This also allows the creators to save their best ideas for creator-owned books rather than work for hire, be it at Image or crowdfunded.
That's the flip side of this in terms of why DC and Marvel tend to not get new ideas.
Right.
You can save those ideas for yourself to farm your own IP.
Right. After you've kind of gotten some recognition and name knowledge, you can then go and start your own independent work or with another independent company. It's why Image and Dark Horse have all the good stuff.
There's some truth to that.
DC tends to be leaning more heavily into the singular nature of their characters, much like Tarzan, Sherlock Holmes, and Godzilla, quote-unquote everybody, knows Superman and Batman, so why reinvent the wheel? Of course, this then allows you to make derivatives such as Batman Who Laughs, which plays off that well-known and singular nature, as an easy sell to your readers. I think that we will see something similar to the back half DC Walmart initiative in the near future, with news stories chopped up into smaller chapters going digital first before being collected in print, such as we're seeing with Tom King and Andy Kubert's Up in the Sky from Superman Giant. This could drive consumers to the app without completely abandoning physical printing. To me, the most recent breakthrough characters, honestly, are Cable and Deadpool. Yes, Cable is the son of Cyclops and Jean Grey, sort of.
Sort of.
But he's an original character. Same with Deadpool. Both have supported numerous titles and are popular enough to be adapted to other media and sell merchandise. Anti-90s fans may gnash their teeth over it, but it's true.
And we will point out that it's been basically 30 years since these, quote, most recent breakthrough characters were created.
It's true. On the DC side, I've seen some people say the same for Harley Quinn. But she's something of a special case. An adapted character from animation, who some consider just a female version of the Joker. But I'm down to include Harley. She was Joker adjacent, but not a new version thereof, and no one can argue with her ability to anchor titles, cross over to other media, and sell merch. Literally this morning, I parked next to a car with Harley Quinn seat covers. And Harley Quinn and Deadpool do have a kind of parallelism with... I'm not going to climb up on my Harley Quinn soapbox, because I've already climbed up on a couple of them today, and I need to save my energy. But she really is an interesting comparison to Deadpool in that Deadpool is the openly sardonic, fourth wall breaking, chaotic, neutral, et cetera, character who people do get really invested in. Harley Quinn is interesting because she's a really good character vessel for satire. And I don't think that people really saw that at the very beginning. I think it's something that she has grown into with time. And as now, Harley is definitely an established character, having 30 years of history in the zeitgeist nearly. People have complained about this before as far as her not actually filling her role. And I mean, like, in the literary context of the Harlequin. But it's, I think it is actually starting to come back that people are seeing her, her potential for doing really, really, really good satire specifically. Comedy, yes. Social commentary, also yes.
One other interesting note about Harley is that she has been in so many different properties, types of properties, animation, live action, comics, and in so many different costumes. That you can cosplay Harley in a an almost After Dark way. They're also family friendly and relatively covered up and cutesy ways that you can cosplay Harley as well. So there are a variety of different images and concepts and contexts for that character.
Yeah. I love Harley Quinn. Sorry, I don't think about it very often. I really love Harley Quinn. Dr. Harlene Quinzel is my love. Thank you so much for bringing her up so that I could just sit in that love for a moment, because as a result of the comics industry and our IP and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, like, I love her. And as a character, I also love her. Harley.
Luke says, in the end, I do think that the current model will limp on for a while longer until Diamond is no longer able to keep their doors open. Then the real fun begins. Thanks for the fun show. Eager to hear whatever you discuss in the future. Thanks, Luke. And thank you, Luke, for not adding soon. Appreciate that, buddy. You know, I think Luke gets us. I think that's...
And from our great, good friend, Podcasting's Michael Bailey, M and Professor. Hearing you two talk comics is always a good way to start the week. I'm listening to your thoughts on the current state of the comics industry with great interest. This is a subject I've been thinking about a lot recently, and honestly, I have no idea why. I'm semi-retired as a collector, as comics are like the Catholic Church, the CIA, vampirism. You're never really out. So the day-to-day or week-to-week comic business isn't on my radar. I'm not buying physical single-issue books on anywhere near a regular basis, and my digital buys are all older and on sale. I've picked up the occasional new book digitally, but it has to be a big deal. What this means is that ultimately, I don't have a dog in the race. I'm on the outside looking in with a bizarre fascination. Kind of like seeing a friend you don't hang out with anymore on Facebook. You do want them to be doing well, but you're not a part of the equation anymore. It's weird being in this position, because I had assumed I'd always be interested in this, and that comics would always be around. When you're into something for decades, you assume that it will go on eternally, especially if it was already there for decades before you even got there. But all things end, or change, or evolve. In the history of distributing comics, Diamond was one of the only games in town for a relatively short amount of time, and I don't think its near-monopolistic hold was healthy for the industry. I'm ready to see what's next. Should be interesting, at the very least. Thank you for a thought-provoking listen. Take care, Podcastics. Michael Bailey.
Now, because of the length of that episode, we cut the part where we were going to talk about our own current states of comics. And since it's been almost 2 years... maybe let's just do a brief discussion here. You know, and for me, my future with comics is not unlike Mr. Bailey's. Uncertain at best. You know, we were down to one regular print book during the pandemic, and that was Doctor Doom. And then we got down to zero. The exception was I picked up the 4-issue miniseries Lady Mechanica.
Yes.
So now I'm probably on a pick up 4 issues every 18 months or so schedule. Whenever Joe Benitez comes up with another storyline for Lady M, it's possible that's the only thing I will be picking up as a physical, cover your ears, floppy for the foreseeable future.
Can I also just say, I love your love of Lady Mechanica.
She's awesome.
She's amazing. Not unlike your love of the Virgin Mary. I love your love. Oh, have I sparked a dark...
Hello, Darkness to Light episode.
I can literally see the gears turning behind your eyes.
M, comic books.
For myself, it's the same.
Yep.
I have not been reading comics for a solid 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. I've also not been reading many physical books. Mm-hmm. And I've talked about this, you know, quite openly on Darkness to Light as far as mental health goes. But it's like with pandemic, with job changes, with life changes, all those sorts of things, it makes it difficult to keep up with new content, right, new stories. If anything, when I'm getting something, it's an older series that I loved, right, or an older character that I enjoyed, or some sort of thing that in some way connects to a part of my fandom past. I'm not really looking to my fandom future in comics anymore.
That's kind of a cool way to say it, I think.
Thank you.
Interesting.
My one exception, it's hardly even an exception at this point, is Constantine.
Mm.
I have sort of settled, now that I am 30 years old, into my primary comic character. It's like, who is your pull into comics? Right. Is it Superman, Batman, Flash, Green Lantern? Is it Cap? Is it Iron Man? Is it Doom? Like, who is your person? Mm-hmm. And in my case, my person is JC.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to continue being interested in the things that he's appearing in, but I don't really have any ties to ongoing stuff, to keeping up with extended media, all of that period of my life of being involved in the fandom aspect, in the overarching universe aspect, the multiverse, multiple media stuff. I think I'm mostly done with that. It's basically just Constantine and Daredevil here and there as they spark my interest.
Very briefly, where and how are you getting your geek on these days then? Is it video games mostly?
For the most part, it's video games. And I will say, the only two things that I have considered buying recently as graphic novels are ElfQuest, Complete Edition Volume 1.
Nice.
Which is so pretty. And
oh, it's pretty.
Dragon Age, the first 5 graphic novels.
Yep.
Because that's my pull.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy comics and I like having them, but as far as being involved in, as a couple of people said, I'm not there for the medium in the same way that I used to be.
I'm there for the stories. And the stories can come in other forms as well.
Precisely.
Interesting. Thank you. And, you know, Michael raised an interesting point in his email saying that, you know, things end, things change. Because we have kind of a brief announcement.
Which is that we've been away for a bit. We're back now. But this isn't an open-ended return. This is not season 6 of Supernatural. This is episode 69. And it is also the start of
the countdown to final short box.
We are currently announcing a 6-episode miniseries with as strict a release date as Alan Moore would have that will wrap up the show with the phenomenal blowout final episode 75.
There have been some topics that have been on our list of things to cover since the very first time we made a list of things to cover. So there are a couple things we will definitely be getting to.
For literally nine years.
But we hope to do a mix and match of short box style topics and concepts and thoughts and episodes. And then, like Em said, some sort of big blowout episode 75 going away party.
I would say a final episode to rival Stella Moose in length and content.
There's a chance.
There is a chance.
There is a chance. So with that big announcement, I think it's about time to call this one an episode. And as we said, 9 years, thank you for sticking with us for all these years. And hopefully you'll be sticking with us another 6 Short Box Showcase episodes. We appreciate you.
All are welcome and loved.
And remember, when you hear us talk about anything, including talking about our plans for Short Box Showcase episodes in the future,
please remember,
we are not experts.
We are just family.